Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from thousands of successful individuals from around the world. I'm your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm delighted to welcome a very accomplished professional from Colorado, USA, Andrea Nelson Trice. Andrea, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Ashutosh.
Andrea is the president of Catalyst Research, LLC. She's a senior associate of the National Institute for Social Impact and an affiliate faculty member of the Regis University. And her most recent book is Strong Together, Building Partnerships Across Cultures in an Age of Distrust. And we'll talk about her book as well. So, Andrea, before we talk about Catalyst Research, tell me about your own journey in brief.
You know, it's interesting because I think for me, my journey into what I ended up doing research on and consulting around really started in childhood. Mm-hmm. I spent part of my childhood in the Peruvian rainforest and remember, still have vivid memories of being exposed to contrasts that I needed to make sense of. And it's taken in some ways my whole life to try and make sense of them. But what is real wealth? You know, living in an area that didn't have a lot of economic prosperity in it, but seeing people with deep contentment and rich relationships. And, you know, and so just kind of contrasting that with sometimes what American culture says is wealth, it caused some questions. And then just watching Westerners who were there to help people that were fairly vulnerable mm-hmm. with literacy, with medical training, with medical services, a variety of different things, mm-hmm. but not always seeing gratitude, sometimes seeing friction. And so that question of how is it that Westerners are most helpful mm-hmm. in majority world or global South countries? What mm-hmm. is it that makes for an effective approach to right. helping others? And when does it that friction ensues, and why is that? So those are things that have led me to do various research studies over the years. I was a faculty member for several years. Mm-hmm. And then I do research, well, and consulting around program evaluation, both for organizations that are here in the States and then also around the world and in the global South. And so that's, yeah.
Amazing, amazing. So let's talk about Catalyst Research. Tell me about the work you do there.
Okay. So I am an independent consultant and work both with nonprofit organizations and social enterprises here in the States, and then work with them in the global South and majority world countries around the world. And so what I do is to help organizations assess if they're doing what they think they're doing. So here's our mission. This is what we're hoping to make a difference with. Are we doing that? And so I help them formulate questions, and then we talk about how to gather data that would be useful. Mm-hmm. And then I go out and create surveys or do focus groups or observation or whatever it is, and then help after I've analyzed all the data to look at what is it that you can do with this? You know, where are you meeting your mark, and where could you really do better work?
Fascinating. And, you know, you just spoke a little bit about culture and working in the Caribbean. How do power dynamics differ across cultures? And what impact does this have on international development efforts?
I would say that there are a couple different ways to think about power dynamics. So there's the formal theoretical. Gerd Hofstede did some phenomenal work over decades looking mm-hmm. at power distance and how many Western cultures and others have a fairly equality, like an equal perspective about different people. Everybody should have power. There are other cultures where the assumption is that elders or just people that are in leadership positions, they should have the power and it shouldn't be equal. Mm-hmm. We should defer to those who are in power. So those kinds of differences, especially when we don't recognize our more equity, you know, focused assumptions as Westerners, that can really cause problems if we go into a community and don't go to the elders, but we just go to individuals in the community and say, hey, this is our idea. We're not deferring to power like it would be culturally appropriate to do.
Right.
The other way is just to think about how power, how having finances when we go in with international development programs, how having those, you know, the purse strings, how having money, how having networks around the world, how having credentials, formal educational credentials, those kinds of power symbols really do make a difference in relationships. And so then information isn't really shared, trust isn't built, and misunderstandings ensue because people don't really share the information that needs to be shared for it to be an effective program.
Well said, thank you. And you also spoke a little bit about, you know, how when Westerners tend to help people in some of the lesser developed areas, and sometimes it's not understood. I wanted to ask, get your perspective on how important is cultural sensitivity in the work that you're doing?
Yeah, it is hard to overestimate and overspeak the power, the importance of cultural sensitivity. Mm-hmm. One of the things as an evaluator, so I come in, I'm typically hired by the organization itself or an outside funder to come in and say, are you achieving what you think you're achieving? Mm-hmm. But the important thing, one of the important things is to look at, well, are you achieving what the people that you're trying to help want? What are their values? What are their goals? Because it's in some ways far less important to be achieving the outsider's goals than to be achieving what the people in the community want and need. And so I think those questions are very, very important to ask.
Interesting. So let's talk a little bit now about social enterprises and the work you do with the NGO sector. How can you share your approach to evaluating the impact of social enterprises? And this seems to be a question all over the world.
Yeah. So in general, this is a program evaluator, to listen to both organizational leaders, funders. There are multiple agendas going on that you need to measure, but then also, you know, again, the community. One of the things that I've been involved with for 5 or 6 years now is to actually not just evaluate, but to assign values to the various kinds of impact that social enterprises are having. Mm-hmm. So not just what difference is it making economically for people, mm-hmm. but to say, has hope increased? Mm-hmm. Has a purpose and a focus, a plan for the next 5 years, has that increased? Mm-hmm. Do people feel empowered? Do they have more tools? Do they feel more self-respect and dignity? Mm-hmm. You know, those kind of things are hard to measure. And then sometimes we go on and actually assign monetary values to that, so that the story becomes one that business people are really used to, where there's a dollar value to what difference are we making? If we assign values to these both concrete outcomes, but also intangible outcomes, are you making a difference? And is it worth the investment that's flowing into this program? So a variety of ways to evaluate social enterprises.
Interesting. And Andrea, how do you navigate the ethical complexities that arise in international development work?
I would say there are a variety of ethical dilemmas that are a part of this. You know, so there's the more typical financial dilemmas, financial ethics that, accountability both within the culture and then outside of the culture, those kinds of things. But I think to me, one of the conversations that we don't often enough have are around unintended consequences and even negative consequences. So we bring a program in, sometimes without community leadership involvement, without the voices of those we're trying to help. We make assumptions about what we're going to accomplish and the good that that's going to do. But what we don't ask is what's happening to people as a result. And so, like I in the interviews for the book that I'm just releasing, there's a story in there about a well that was put into a community because they didn't have access to fresh water that wasn't a couple of kilometers away. Mm-hmm. An American perspective is that this is incredibly inefficient and you can't keep going like this. You can't keep walking for water every day, you know, for half an hour or something. But the reality was, after this big celebration, the women bypassed the well and continued to walk 2 villages away to get clean water. Mm. And this didn't make any sense to the program leaders. But what the people explained to me was, this was in Ghana in this case, but what the people explained was, there's a social element that program leaders never sought to understand. Mm. They never understood that the women go to get water, and during that time, they talk with each other, they share about their frustrations in their family, with their marriages. And they come back, and like one of the people said, you know, the problems are solved. There's no problem. Yeah. And you're introducing social problems by putting a well into our community. Mm. It would never dawn on Americans to to assume that that might happen. And so I think, to me, that's an ethical problem that we have to look at, is what kind of changes are we seeking to interject? And are those, in fact, positive changes for our community?
Thank you. What a great example you've given. And I'm sure there are so many similar examples of how culture really drives a lot of social behavior.
Yes.
But moving on, Andrea, how should nonprofits and social enterprises approach the challenge of securing sustainable funding?
If, you know, if anybody had a simple answer, we would have done it by now. So I'm not going to answer that, you know, in full. But I think, so I am primarily a qualitative researcher. I do a lot with interviews and with observation and with focus groups and things. And to me, one of the most powerful things that organizations can do is to keep a library of stories. This is what happened because we only got funding for 3 years. This is what happened because we got funding for a much longer period of time. I was working with an organization in a, we'll just call it a war-torn area of Northern Africa, Sub-Saharan Northern Africa, last summer. And it was a 3-year grant that they had, but war broke out. And almost 1 year of the 3 years was obliterated. They couldn't do anything. And it was an agriculturally focused program, helping farmers to have some new tools and access to better seeds and access to markets for their, you know, for their produce. It was a neat program, but because the funding was only 3 years and when the war took 1 year of it away, the program didn't get anywhere near as much traction as it needed. And farmers didn't adopt things and keep things going.
Right.
So those kinds of stories to me will make should make funders really listen more carefully and think about the risk of not funding for a longer period of time.
Interesting. And given all the work that you are doing in so many different countries, I want to ask you about technology. And the question is, how, in your view, is technology influencing the way NGOs and, you know, are able to measure their impact over the years?
That's an interesting question because, again, I do a lot with, you know, I use Zoom and things like that to gather information, but I'm not a high-tech person. But here are some examples. With surveys, we are now able to have people answer on their phones rather than having to come to a place and either hand, you know, work with pencil and paper or work with like an organization's iPad that they don't own themselves. Going back to that question about power distance, having that maybe anonymity and privacy as they answer really turns out to be very important. In a country, in a culture where there's a wide power distance, people, you know, if they're in a room with somebody who's a leader, they may not talk at all. And if they do talk, they're not going to go against anything the leader says. And we as Americans, that is so not how we operate. We've got an opinion, we share it. But in other cultures, we've got to understand that. And so being able to answer using technology rather than face-to-face can be really powerful, and it can get us far better information about what's really going on the ground. Sending text messages and saying, hey, what are you doing right now? Or how are you feeling right now? So getting like a really quick feedback about a specific question can get better response rates and really different kinds of information than like a paper and pencil survey that's, you know, that's sent out 6 months after a project is launched. There's big data things too that I don't, you know, work with, but I was working with a group last summer that they build bridges across, let's say, just say canyons where during the rainy season, they're impassable. And so these bridges that allow people to still have access to education, commerce, medical services and things during the rainy season. And they're using GPS to track the use of these bridges and to track the needs, like identifying the need ahead of time. If we build a bridge, you know, how much are patterns of travel affected by raining, by rain and stuff. So those are some interesting ways that technology is bettering the way that we assess outcomes.
Fascinating. So I have two more questions for you relating to Catalyst Research and the work you're doing, and then I want to talk about your book. Andrea, can you share a particularly successful project or partnership you've been a part of and what made it successful? And it looks like you're doing a lot of work in Africa.
I am. And yeah, so I think what I would do is give you an example, and it's actually a multi-continent social enterprise. It's based in Michigan in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clean water. So they provide filters.
Mm.
Well, I shouldn't say provide, they build filters. But so it's called Aqua Clara International, and they are producing, their filters are producing millions of liters of water every day. Mm. It is phenomenal. They're across the continents and really doing some neat work. But they came in with some very distinct assumptions that were not very American. One was, we're not going to market what we're doing.
Mm.
Our connections and word of mouth is going to bring people to say, hey, we would like this for our community. And so when they partner with, whether it's a place in Mexico or a place in Nairobi, wherever it is, they already have buy-in from the community. And they work with schools, with churches, with local governments. They work with intact organizations that, again, coming back to that power distance idea, they recognize the organizational structure of a community and don't try and bypass that. Mm-hmm. They spend the time building relationships, building trust, working through schools, working through churches that are in the community. And they only use local resources. They do mm-hmm. not import or export, you know, filters from the US. So the filters look different in every country
mm-hmm.
based on the resources that are there. There are a variety of things that they have done. And it's phenomenal when you think about like the statistics about wells, and like half of wells within 2 years aren't even functioning anymore. But their filters mm-hmm. are still in use 10, 15 years later. It's just it's a neat, it makes sense the way it's being done. And it took a lot of patience, but I've been impressed with their work.
Amazing. Great example. Thank you. My next question is, what trends, and if you were to look at your crystal ball, what trends do you currently see emerging in the field of international development and social entrepreneurship?
So a big one that I think a lot of people would be familiar with is decolonization.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole idea of recognizing
mm-hmm.
how much power Westerners often bring into developing communities, and recognizing that we don't have all the answers, and mm-hmm. that it needs to be a very different dynamic when programs are launched and built, you know, built up. What I would, in terms of the trend, my best guess is that we are moving, if you think about it in terms of a pendulum, we are moving from a colonized perspective to a decolonized. And I do see a lot of pushback in terms of Westerners' roles, even. Do they belong? Do we belong? Mm. Is there, you know, what is our role at this point?
Right.
In doing research for my book, you know, this was like 90 interviews that I did and a number of case studies. What I heard over and over again from people in a variety of majority rule countries was that, for the most part, what they were saying to me was, we don't want you to go home and stay home, but you got to recognize what you do and don't bring and what we have to offer. And so this partnership idea needs to be really played out in a very different way. So Americans do have access to financial capital. We know how to get funding. We know how to write grants. We tend to have far more entrepreneurial training and experience than many people in other countries do.
Absolutely.
So those kinds of things are really valuable, but that needs to be coupled with a humility mm. and recognizing what we don't have: local mm. social capital, mm. understanding of poverty, just understanding of cultural norms. I mean, there are all kinds of things that Americans, Westerners don't bring. Mm. The other trend I would say, which is somewhat, you know, related to this, is the empowerment of local leaders to build social enterprises
mm-hmm.
or, you know, other kinds of nonprofit organizations
mm-hmm.
on their own, and then tap Westerners maybe as consultants, maybe for help with getting financial resources,
mm-hmm.
but also just to use the labs, the laboratories that they don't have in their own country, but that they need if they're going to develop maybe a medical device or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's empowering local leaders to do the building, to create these new programs,
mm.
but having them in a very professional way consult mm. with people from other countries and tapping mm. the resources that are there. So I love that trend. Mm. I'm really excited about it.
Fascinating. So Andrea, let's now talk about your book, Strong Together, Building Partnerships Across Cultures in an Age of Distrust. And I'm going to ask all of yours and go and check out Andrea Nelson's book, and I'm going to check out the book myself. So tell me about your book, and what was the hypothesis when you wrote it?
You know, it kind of goes back to the beginning of our conversation. I mean, it does. It was very much, you know, Westerners and Americans in particular, I believe, generally speaking, have good hearts and want to help the world's most vulnerable people.
Correct.
But the friction that happens so often and the failed programs, you know, there's this incredibly high number of programs that only last as long as the Westerners are there. And once they're gone, the program ends.
Correct.
And so trying to understand, what does it look like to have a really healthy partnership? What does it look like when synergy actually happens and Americans and people from another country come together with their each unique set of assets and build something that together, like apart, neither one of them could have built in the same way.
Right.
So that was the question, was what does it look like when things really go well? And why is it that there's so much friction most of the time when we go into other countries to try and help?
Fascinating. And my last question about your book, what key strategies do you suggest for building successful partnerships across cultures?
One of the things is to understand the assumptions that you're operating under, because most of the time, perhaps, we don't articulate our assumptions. Westerners and Americans in particular, we tend to value economic progress, economic stability. And so we go in with that as the named problem. But what I heard over and over again from multiple countries' leaders is people that were involved with social enterprise, involved with international development in their own country, was that their goal was empowerment, help people to find hope, to have their dignity restored. That is so much more important. And once they are there with some tools, but feeling empowered, they'll take it and run. They will develop their own priorities. And so I think that is one of the most important things, is to understand that we, at the most foundational level, define the problem differently. From that comes all kinds of problems and misunderstandings.
Very well said. And on that note, Andrea, and our amazing conversation, thank you so much for speaking to me about your own journey. Thank you for speaking to me about the social sector, culture, trends. I love the way you spoke about how Westerners have tremendous amount of strengths, but there are some areas where you think Westerners do need to make some changes to be able to understand the rest of a large part of the world. I also, you know, I served on the board of Gavi for 8 years, Global Alliance for Vaccines. And I do know, based on data, that Americans are the biggest givers in the world. They give the largest amount of money is given away by Americans. I don't think any other country comes even close to it. Thank you also for speaking to me about your book. I really appreciated the way you said, you know, sometimes we don't understand the assumptions, where it is important to understand how important empowerment is versus an economic success, and economic success will follow. I'd love to talk to you again at length sometime about culture, because that's an area that I would love to explore much more. But thank you for speaking to me, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.